Just gone 7 o'clock here in Amsterdam, and that means quarter past nine in Doha in Qatar. It means it's midday lunchtime in New York, early morning San Francisco, and the people in Australia are sleeping it off, all their activities the last couple of days. I've been looking around on the web for more interesting news, and I found a site called motherjones.com with an article about it's labeled a bitter pill for the WTO. This is really interesting. It says something about the double standards in the world of these days. Medicines are patented, and that means that the poorer countries can't always pay it. Only in terms of emergency can these laws be bypassed, and what is so typical is that in the States, because of the recent anthrax crisis, Cipro, which is a very common antibiotic for lung and urinary tract infections, has suddenly become incredibly cheap and is also being manufactured in Canada instead of in Germany, where it is normally manufactured. Bayer has the copyright, has the patent of Cipro. Quoting a piece from the site on motherjones.com, faced with growing concerns about the anthrax threat, health officials in the US and Canada pressured Bayer to provide Cipro at far below the asking price. The Canadian government took steps to override the Bayer patent, licensing a Canadian pharmaceutical firm to make a generic version of the drug. In the United States, Bayer officials slashed their asking price for Cipro to 95 cents a tablet, down from the original retail price of approximately $4.50 per tablet. Personally, I find that very shocking. Further on, it says, the WTO's current agreement on trade-related aspects of intellectual property rights, or TRIPS, as they are better known, allows governments to bypass patents in national health emergencies. It was that provision which both Ottawa and Washington cited in their negotiations with Bayer. While the Cipro patent was not actually set aside by either the US or Canada, Littleston said Washington's maneuvering has made the already thorny fight over drug patents even more contentious. Well, my question is HIV, malaria, tuberculosis, and all the other infectious diseases in developing countries in Africa, Asia, South America, are those not national emergencies? Anyways, the discussion about intellectual property is a very interesting one. I have found a site as well on the internet which asks people to write, what does intellectual property mean to me? This was actually a reaction to the World Intellectual Property Organization, the WIPO. They launched an international student essay competition asking students to write essays about what intellectual property means to them. This site, Wipeout without an E, .net, did a kind of a counter-reaction, and they asked people to, for example, write essays about why I can't purchase anti-HIV drugs because of the patent law, or why, as a farmer, I can't get access to patent-protected seeds for planting, or, for example, why I, as a teacher, can't distribute materials to my students due to copyright restrictions. Everyone, have a look at this site on the internet. It's www.wipout. So you would say it wipeout, but it's actually spelled wipout.net. Right, this is Radio No New Round in Amsterdam, coming live at 7:20, so that means it's about 9:20 in Doha, and I think all the people who've been having their political meetings all day are sitting at the dinner table with wine and champagne, etc., etc.
You won't. No New Round Radio, live from Amsterdam, and we have a new report from Geneva, Switzerland. And it says, on Saturday at 2 p.m., the 10th of November, 10,000 people gathered on the Place Niveau in the center of Geneva. The crowd was very mixed. Groups from all Switzerland, France, Italy, Germany, and elsewhere. Zapatistas, Green Party, squatters, autonomists, farmers, students, etc. We go on. There's a long list. Attack people, anarchists, Kurds, Turkish, socialists, worker unions, and individuals were there. Demonstration went from the Place Niveau to the back area where the symbolic actions began. Actions such as bank spraying, painting, glued posters with "the ads killed me" or "peace is free" and "if money was worth nothing." It continues here. It says the world versus OMC, buying American products, sponsorize bombs in Afghanistan, react, and a smile is free. The actions went on with painting fly. Sorry, I'm reading literally from this text. Painting flying on the nice stores, the banks, and all symbols of the consumer society and capitalism. Burn capitalism sprayed on the walls. This is a report from Switzerland. I continue. There are also a few broken windows, a few Molotov cocktails on the police stones in nice hotels. A lot of things going on in Geneva, Switzerland today. Continues. The police was very paranoid and was ready for the worst that they prevented. I didn't really get that, but anyway. The demonstration was a success, ending in front of the headquarters of the WTO, where the radicals provoked at the police. The police screamed a few notices and fainted to charge the demo, ended by 6 p.m. today. That was about 1 hour ago, local time. And no arrested people. It was a peaceful end. And this article is posted on the Global Indymedia site, so it's www.indymedia.org. And this article ends with "Smash Capitalism." This is No New Round Radio, live from Amsterdam.
We'll be right back. Still trying. It's working? Okay, sorry, I just say, this is Chema from calling in from Radio Doha in Qatar at this point, and he will tell us a little bit what's been going on there.
Okay, so let me just say that my name is Chema Hernandez. I'm calling in from Doha. Right, I'm here on the Rainbow Warrior, helping out No New Round Radio Doha. Just to give an update of what's going on here in Doha, everything has been, the meeting just started, so there's not a lot of things going on. A lot of rumors flying around. It's probably going to get worse near the end, though. Let's see, I've gotten to talk to the Japanese delegation. Essentially, what's going on with them is that they brought in a whole lot of people, 160 or 140, and a lot of them are just essentially here on vacation. This was what one delegate told me. So essentially, they're just trying to flood here with a lot of rich countries with delegates, sort of to confuse the situation. On top of that, let's see what else. Well, the security is extremely tight. It's scary. Near the red area, the red zone, you start getting closer and closer, and the more police you see, the more roadblocks, body armor, machine guns, everything. The works, very spooky. What else? Apparently the Qatari government evacuated large parts of the city, essentially to make the red area larger than it needed to be. So a lot of people here have been displaced, I guess, almost refugees within their own country, within their own city even. So quite unnecessary, I think, since, there's nobody here.
Could you tell me more about this red area?
Well, the red zone, that's, I guess, what everybody here is calling it. It's essentially the zone that nobody can enter without the WTO accreditation, be it the NGO, delegate, or press, right? You just can't enter. You just can't enter. You have to have the accreditation, the little plastic card with you, with your photo and your country or your organization, and that's it.
So what's the situation outside this area?
Outside the area, life is going on as normal. Most people are, in fact, are just not very aware of what's going on outside. I walked around, talked to a few people. Most of their complaints were generally with the Qatari government. Here, Qatar is 75% foreigners. At least that's what they were telling me. And there's a lot of limits in the freedoms of these people, of the majority of these 75% foreigners. They really have other things to worry about.
So how's the interest been from other media?
In other media, on what? On
the protests there in Qatar.
There has been a lot of interest, definitely. There's a lot of people. Essentially, every country has at least a major newspaper or television here. Unfortunately, the WTO has restricted them a whole lot. You have to be a national newspaper. You can't be a regional newspaper. You can't even have, you can't even be a reporter for a couple or several regional newspapers. They just won't allow it. So there's limited manpower, definitely.
Yeah, can you tell me some what's going to happen later on today and tomorrow?
Well, I really can't say because since it's so short, the meetings, you know, they last less than a week. It can fluctuate a whole lot. The meetings are just going to continue. Maybe perhaps we will start to see if the trade talks, if the talks will actually work, if they will go ahead or if they'll collapse like they did in Seattle. That's about it. A continuation. You know, the tension here is high. We'll see what's going on. Right now we're broadcasting from the Rainbow Warrior, a pirate signal. It's a radio station. We're broadcasting it in loops. Eventually we're going to go live with it and, essentially try to inform people around here and near the Sheraton Hotel where the meeting is being held of what's going on.
What do you recommend us to do to help you out there?
Well, we want to know what's going on over there, you know, and around the world. Updates. We want to keep the people informed because essentially everybody here is too busy to keep up with demonstrations and events around the world. So we would appreciate it, you know, if once we call, you can update us on it.
Would you like me to say something about that now?
About what?
About updating you?
Yeah.
Okay, so, here in Amsterdam, we have been trying to coordinate content that is live interviews and also MP3s that people have been uploading from all over the world, from different actions against the world, against the WTO.
Yeah.
And one of them that I'm looking at right now, that's the global site of Indymedia, so that's www.indymedia.org. And they're updating the various protests very well.
Okay. Look, let me stop here for a second because I'm going to have to go now, essentially, to get prepared for the programming. So it's fine if I call you back, right?
Yeah, sure. I'm not sure I will be here, but someone else will be able to take that call.
Okay, so it will be in about half an hour, I would say.
Okay.
Right. You're going to be talking to Mel and Meredith about you know the updates. So So the first thing the person should answer should say, you know, my name is the name of the person, because if it's not you, then it's going to be kind of difficult for the people answer it. So I'm going to tell them, I don't know. I'll tell them to ask who's calling, right? And introduce yourself and say you're from INC and right?
Thank you. World Trade Organization insist that at the meetings in Doha, the concerns of developing countries are going to be prioritized. But if this is so, why is it that a growing number of so-called developing countries are insisting that their concerns and needs are not being taken seriously? In this piece, Scott Sinclair, a senior researcher with the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives, tells us why the meeting in Doha is so important. He also talks about Canada's agenda and what its impact may be on poor countries.
Why is this meeting in Doha important?
Well, this is a critical meeting. As you know, the last ministerial meeting in Seattle failed to launch a broad round of negotiations, which would include issues that are not, I would argue, not clearly trade-related, like investment or competition policy or government procurement policies. It failed to do that, and for the last 2 years, representatives of the northern countries in particular, the Quad, have been working furiously to try to build momentum and enough agreement to launch around, and now it's decision time. One of the ironies of Doha is that this new round is being promoted as a development round, but the strongest objections to a new round come from a very large block of developing and least developed countries who say their problem is, look, we can't even implement the obligations that we have now under the World Trade Organization. And we're just not interested or capable of engaging in a new round. But their objections have been largely brushed aside.
Where does the Canadian government stand on this issue?
Well, the Canadian government is a very vociferous proponent of a new round. And we are very hard-nosed, despite our own self-image as a kind of Boy Scouts or peacekeepers in the multilateral arena. At the WTO, we're part of a small minority of rich countries that is basically prepared to use strong-arm tactics to advance our own corporate interests. And I'll give a specific example of that. One of the issues on the table at Doha, one of the important issues on the table at Doha, is a declaration on TRIPS, which are the rules governing intellectual property. And a very large majority of countries, led by Brazil and India, and African countries faced with an AIDS pandemic and other public health crises, want a clear statement that public health should take priority over the intellectual property rules of the WTO, the so-called the TRIPS. Canada is part of a very small number of countries that includes, led by the United States and Switzerland, Japan and Canada, who are obstructing and standing in the way of this and absolutely refusing to go along with that. And I think it's shameful. A clear statement of the priority of public health in the multilateral system would be an important development and would set a good precedent for other negotiations around services and food safety.
That was Scott Sinclair, senior researcher with the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives.
Thank you. Sound Radio, this time live from Amsterdam. I've got on the line Herman. Hello, Herman.
Hello.
The WTO is a big fan of privatization of public services.
Yes, and you can see that happening under pressure from the WTO and also of other organizations like the European Union. You can see it in many countries happening. For instance, in the Netherlands, a few years ago, when students of medicine were studying how to fight lung cancer, when they looked out of the window, they saw a big sign there, a sign of Marlboro cigarettes, which, as everyone knows, gave people cancer. And no matter whether they wanted it or not, if you look out of the window, they saw the Marlboro sign. One of the professors started a court case against that billboard of Marlboro. But the problem is, today, that was a few years ago, today there are propagandistic billboards of the companies inside the universities and
how come? I mean, how is it possible that a public service that was a couple of years ago entirely paid by the state and out of tax money is now in the hands of this corporation? I mean, this is not a thing that started yesterday, and what does the WTO have to do with it?
WTO promotes this kind of policy in its agreement. It says that federal countries should privatize their education. It is in the rules of the WTO. And
What do you think is the reason of the WTO having this policy?
Well, I think they themselves, many of the, they depend on the governments everywhere in the world, especially of rich countries, and the people in these governments all often have strong ties themselves to big multinational corporations, like for instance, well, some of these people in the government, they are so let's say directors or CEOs or something of corporations, or they look forward to a job like having a job like that after they finished as ministers or high-level officials. They will maybe join the boards of multinational corporations. There's quite some exchange between it. And of course, it's totally against the interest of the people in education, against the interest of the students, and the interest of the teachers. It is not only a question of university level education, it's also the commercialization. You can also at education at secondary level and at primary level.
Let me just interrupt here again. Would you know what the official reason is why the WTO promotes this? I mean, I'm sure they don't say because I want to smoke some cigars. In 10 years I will now sell your university, right? I'm sure that they have some kind of a, let's say, official policy, how they defend this.
Well, the theory is, well, more or less, in the United States you have a saying, what is good for General Motors is good for the United States, so market economy is supposed to make education more efficient, etc. In practice, things are often quite different, well, but they will put forward, if they defend this policy, reasons like, well, if something is financed by states, then it's automatically a terribly bureaucracy and etc., etc. Well, as if there are no bureaucracies in privately owned corporations.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I think it's absolutely a question of the size, but let's talk about the effect. I mean, in the Netherlands, universities are privatized since about 10 years or longer, and this tendency is growing. What do you think is the direct effect? I mean, are there now more doctors, less doctors, better doctors? How will you measure it?
Well, I think the quality of the education is clearly suffering. They are reducing the number of years during which students can study, and that means that the education will become more shallow and more superficial. It will also mean for for instance, Belgium, can also see that there are some subjects coming at the university which don't belong at the university because they are not really scientific. For instance, a business school is not scientific and therefore it should not be at the university, but apparently they think at Yale University, there at Harvard, there is a business school. Well, then we should have business schools at universities.
But I understand that in many countries, especially in the first world, where this privatization is taking place, and I'm not talking about the United Kingdom or the United States, because they are second world, I'm talking about northwestern Europe, there has been an attempt to divide these two tasks. I mean, especially in the Netherlands, you have university courses, and then you have HBO courses, higher, how would you translate this? A higher professional education. I mean, what is supposed to be the difference, and does it work out?
Well, in practice, there are more. What in Dutch is called HBO. Maybe it's maybe a bit similar to what in the United States is called community college or something like to a certain extent. It's supposed to be non-scientific and based on professional what people need for practice in a certain occupation or profession, while universities are supposed to be scientific so that you can think critically about about subjects so that you don't have to take at face value what is taught, but are supposed to think. That is supposed historically to be the difference in the Netherlands between university educations and HBO, HBO education. But in practice, the critical thinking at the moment at the university is discouraged by this commercialization, so it's really the difference is becoming less and less basically at the moment.
Europe is now, and I think America might as well very soon, see big student protests. I mean, it was like silenced for about 20 years, I would say, or 10 years when the last blockades took place. And now I see students go to the street again. I mean, is there any serious tendency within, let's say, the students themselves, but also the teachers, to want to turn back this privatization and claim the universities back?
Definitely. Just a few days ago in Spain, there was a strike by 3 million students, and also the university teachers' organization supported this strike. And in a week's time, there will again be a big strike called by the students' unions, but also supported by the teachers' organization. So you see, in Spain, there's a movement in education which really involves millions of people, and many of these students have also plans of coming to Brussels on the 14th of December in the big demonstration against the policy of the European Union. There's a big movement in Germany, in Austria, in Belgium. There's a big movement, for instance, against the so-called Bologna agreement on university education, which also involves the commercialization of education. In the Netherlands, there has been an action by students at the University of Groningen. They have occupied the university administration building in protest against commercialization, and the university management has made some concessions to them. Also in Leiden, a few days ago, there was an action against the commercialization. Some of the commercial publicity billboards, the contents of the billboards, it was taken away and it was brought to Schiphol to be sent to Qatar for the World Trade Organization conference because it belongs there and doesn't belong on the university.
So, but the university has two tasks, as far as I remember. One of them is to teach, and the other one is to research.
Yes.
And all these scientists that are coming from these, like, formerly state-owned universities that are now researching for companies and universities, is there any of this this, let's say, scientific intelligentsia that opposes the the sell out of their research space.
Yes, there definitely is, and for instance, one can hear some of these scientists at the there was a conference a few months ago in Leiden, at a time when there was a protest in Gothenburg against the European Union. And then there was a conference in Leiden called Another World is Possible, where there was also someone representative of the scientific workers at the university in Amsterdam who protested against the commercialization of scientific research. There's also protest among health workers against commercialization and the influence of big companies on the medical research, etc.
Medical research is quite an interesting field, especially also related to this, let's say, intellectual property rights discussions around medicaments very lately. But if I look at healthcare, especially also again in the first world, in northwestern Europe, most of the jobs that are on the market now are in this branch. Do you think that people are now willing to pay for the education to get these jobs? Or do you think that there is no people because they have to pay for the education? Or what is the relation between the education in scientific terrain and our social services?
That is a complicated question, There's one concession, by the way, which the government, Dutch government made recently. For many years there has been a rule in the Netherlands that only a limited number of students could study medicine, but that was in the process of being abolished, so that is really, it was a very ancient demand of the student movement already in the 1960s that the so-called numerus fixus of students in medicine would be abolished as the needs of people all over the world in better healthcare are more important than restricting numbers for financial reasons. And well, and that demand at the moment seems to be met. So there is not the only the tendency that the government promotes more and more worth policies which fit in well for the big corporations, but sometimes they also have to make some, at least some concessions to the movements from below, the opposition movements, yes.
So let's come down to hard names and numbers. I mean, I'm sure that you can give us some, let's say, concrete example of a sold-out university, the companies that bought them, and the name of their product.
Well, there are also one example is that you have many professors in the Netherlands, so-called, well, how you call the so-called special professors, who are not really scientists, but who are, well, basically directors or something or of some company, and who and the corporation pays at least part of their salary, and then they are, university makes them professor, though they basically lack many scientific qualities, but they are really because the government is making cutbacks on the financing, and those at least some of the university administrators say, well, we need another source of money, and then the corporations step in, but of course with strings attached.
Would you know a concrete example of a university teacher, let's say at a Dutch university, that is paid by a concrete corporation? I mean, I would like to be able to identify the owner of my university in the supermarket. I mean, I know that
for instance, Philips, for instance, has many professors. For instance, Mr. Professor Pieper is really a manager of Philips, basically.
So where is he teaching?
Yes. I think in Eindhoven University. Eindhoven University is basically a rather clear example. It is in the city of Eindhoven in the southeastern Netherlands, and that is basically, well, a sort of company town of Philips from, say, the football soccer club is basically owned, PSV is basically owned by Philips, and the Technical University of Eindhoven is more or less also owned by Philips, the big electronics multinational corporation, yes.
Do you think that there is a chance that Europe and, well, America probably has, will go the way of Japan? I mean, what you told me now about this little Philips town and Eindhoven, and I know that there is a religious relation to this corporation there, things are turning into little Saibatsu zones. Do you think that there is a chance that the European community will go on with this policy and turn ourselves into some kind of a mixture in America, of America and Japan in the next coming 15 years?
It's very possibly, but things also depend, of course, on how strong the resistance is. If the resistance gets even stronger than it is today, they have to make at least some concessions, and if they try push too hard forward a bit too fast, then it may backfire on them and make the resistance stronger, while their intention was to make things easier, to crush resistance, so to say.
Well, I'm sure that we have many students amongst the listeners that heard that story now and say, hey, yeah, my teacher belongs to Marlboro, and let's say they want to protest. I mean, please give us a trail. How can we start? Let's say I'm a university student somewhere in Europe. Can you give us a couple of URLs on the internet or names of organizations so that people can follow the trail and get to know what you find out and maybe more?
Yes. URLs usually start with HTTP, and also in this case, so I found URL of students all across Europe who are protesting. It is HTTP, and then
it's HTTP /, and then the address is
INP,
Liggend streepje. Also it's just www. Punt.
No, it isn't. Not even.
It's ENP.
It doesn't even have www. It's I and T, and then a line, small e. line.
Yeah.
And dash. Then protest.
Protest.
And then another line. And then action.
Action.
And then dot.
Yeah.
And then tripod. TRIPOD.
Pins tripod. Pins com. Okay.
.com. Yes.
Okay. Let's try that out.
Mm-hmm. And there are more.
Yeah. Well, sorry. This page cannot be found. So it's INP.
INT. T, yes.
T for Theater.
It's International Protest Abbreviation, basically, yes. INT, and that...
Whoa, here comes up a lot of corporate publicity, by the way. And then, oh yes, the EU-wide student strike in all kinds of languages, even in Catalan and in Nederlands Vlaams. Oh, what thought. Please go to this site and join the international student protest. If you're a student, then in your own interest, and if you're not, in your solidarity, you might have kids in a couple of years. Would there be another one? Where would you like to send our listeners?
Another one is a discussion group about the actions, and it's also HTTP, etc.
Yeah.
And then /.
Yeah.
Well, then groups, groups. And then dot, and then Yahoo.
.com, yeah, and then?
And then /, and then group.
Yeah.
GROUP, and then /, and then again INT, and again the line, and then scholieren, and then again line, N-E-N, and then line studentenacties, S-T-U-D-E-N-T-E-N. A K T
Well, never mind, Herman. Please try the student strike sites. I'm sure there's going to be some links to lead you there.
In Dutch, the last one which I named is in the Dutch language.
I'm sure people will be able to find it. Well, I thank you very much for the interview.
And I thank you for doing the interview, and good luck with the radio, yes?
Good luck. Thanks. I hope Doha is coming in.
And thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Que ya nadie se para a mirar. Por el suelo hay una mamacita que se muere de no respetar. Pachamama, te veo tan triste. Pachamama, me pongo a llorar. Esperando la última ola, cuídate, no te vaya a mojar. Escuchando la última rola, mamacita, te invito a bailar. Por el suelo camina mi pueblo, por el suelo hay un agujero, por el suelo camina la raza, mamacita, te vamos a matar. Esperando la última ola, Pachamama, me muero de pena. Escuchando la última rola, mamacita, te invito a bailar.
Por el suelo camina mi pueblo, por el suelo muriendo condena. Por el suelo el infierno quema, por el suelo la raza la ciega.
Esperando la última ola, Pachamama, me muero de pena. Escuchando la última rola, mamacita, te invito a bailar. We'll be right back.
confessed. He has made no statement. Charges of murder have been accepted against him.
We'll be right back. başta ulusal ölçekte olmak üzere bütün engelleri yıkıp yok ederek ilişkileri tam anlamıyla piyasalaştırması ve metalaştırması anlamına geliyor. Bu ulusal ölçekte Türkiye başta olmak üzere az gelişmiş ya da gelişmekte olan ülkelerde büyük bir yıkıma neden oluyor. Ülkemizde de bunun benzer örneklerini çok somut şekilde yaşamaktayız. Ekonominin içinde bulduğu kriz, tarımın çökertilmesi, özelleştirme gibi nedenlerle ülkemizde büyük ölçekte bir bunalım yaşanmakta. Ülkemizde kayıtlı işçi sayısı bakımından 1 milyon 600 bin kişi bu nedenlerle işsiz kalmıştır. 2021 yılında da bu sayının 2 milyonun aşacağını çok rahatlıkla söyleyebiliriz. Yine küreselleşmenin bir başka sonucu, kendi bulunduğumuz bölgeden baktığımızda bunu çok daha rahatlıkla söyleyebiliyoruz. Gelişmiş ülkelerin kendi ülkelerinde görmek istemediği kirli sanayilerin bizim gibi gelişmiş al geçmiş ülkelere kaydırılmasıdır. Bunun örnekleri petrokimya, gemi çekim tesisleri, demir çelik fabrikaları, gübre fabrikaları şeklinde sayılabilir. Bu fabrikalar faaliyetleri bakımından başta çalışanlar olmak üzere yöre halkı ve çevre üzerinde ciddi tahribatlara neden olmaktadır. Bunun yine basit göstergelerinden bir tanesi, basit ama acı göstergelerinden bir tanesi, kendi bulunduğumuz ve örgütlü olduğumuz işyerlerimizde karaciğer, böbrek kanserleri nedeniyle ciddi ölçüde ölümlerin varlığını söyleyebiliriz ki bu sayının çok daha artacağına ilişkin ciddi kuşkularımız var. Yine demir çelik fabrikaları ve bu teknolojinin etkisi altına aldığı bölgelerdeki halkın, insanların saydığım nedenlerle başta çocuklar olmak üzere ölümlerinde ciddi bir artış olduğunu gözlemliyor. Dünyanın aydınlık geleceğinin yalnızca küreselleşme karşıtlarının bir arada duruşundan geçtiğini düşünüyorum. Aksi halde önümüzdeki 100 yıl içerisinde dünyamıza sermayenin tam anlamıyla hakim olduğu ve her şeyi metalaştırdığı, her şeyi piyasalaştırdığı, parayla ölçtüğü karanlık bir 100 yıl gelecektir diye düşünüyorum.
blame the government or blame society?
Or should we blame the images on TV?
No! Blame Canada!
Blame Canada!
With all their beady little eyes, the clapping heads are full of lies.
Blame Canada! Blame Canada!
You need to form a force off!
Get Canada off!
Don't blame me for my son Stan. He saw the darn cartoon and now he's off to join the clan. And my boy Eric once had my picture on his shelf. But now when I see him, it tells me to fuck myself. Well, blame Canada!
Blame Canada!
It seems that everything's gone wrong since Canada came along.
Blame Canada! Blame Canada!
They're not even a real country anyway.
My son could have been a doctor or a lawyer, rich and true. They said he burned a pack of piggy on a barbecue.
Should we blame the matches?
Should we blame the fire?
Or the doctors who allowed it to expire?
Heck no!
Blame Canada! Blame Canada!
With all the hockey hullabaloo and that bitch and Murray too.
Blame Canada! Shame on Canada!
Again, this is No New Round Radio, still live from Amsterdam, the Netherlands, reporting on the WTO conference and the protests against it. We now have a text report from Thatcher, who was yesterday at the protest from NGO delegates. I will just read it. So this is a report from an action in Doha yesterday. About 65 members of non-governmental organizations attending the WTO ministerial in Doha blocked the door exiting the hall of the Doha Sheraton Hotel. Robert B. Zulek, I think, yeah, the United States Trade Representative, gave a press conference in that room after the official accession of China to the WTO. Among the NGO delegates were José Bové from Via Campesina, Vandana Shiva from the Research Foundation for Science, Technology and Natural Resource Policy, Maud Barlow, the Council for Canadians, and Walden Bellow, the focus on the Global South. They stood toe-to-toe with the Qatari security as they and over 60 others chanted in English and then French, "What's going on behind closed door? Arm twisting, arm twisting." They held signs saying, "Arm twisting." The protest was organized 20 minutes before it happened. More protests are planned for the next few days. Last night, many of the same people stood outside with tape over their mouths before the opening session as trade ministers entered the Sheraton. Developing countries are threatened to vote to stop a new trade round over the issues of expanding agriculture, trade liberalization, AIDS drug patent protection, and the lack of a commitment to development. Vandana Shiva said, "The majority of countries are silent systematically. The pretension of consensus goes on, and an anti-consensus, anti-democratic treaty that is shaped under machine guns, under security forces, is not worth celebrating. We want a democratic treaty." Walden Bellow challenged WTO Director General Michael Moore yesterday in an NGO briefing about the so-called mini-ministerials that were held in Mexico and Singapore. Maud Barlow said at the protest that the same sort of exclusion continues at this official ministerial. "We are hearing terrible stories from the developing country delegates that they are being told what to do. They got brought into this meeting in the first place with a text they didn't agree to. And the text was announced the first night as if it was agreed by everybody, but it never was agreed. And now they're told they are not even going to have proper meetings with each other. There's going to be somebody assigned to go to get some consensus." Zulek announced that at the press conference, "I believe that as this century unfolds and people look back on it today, they will conclude that in admitting China to the WTO, we took a decisive step in shaping the global economic and commercial system. In a sense, the organization War on Want agrees. This means that millions of workers elsewhere in the world will face wage cuts and unemployment due to the low labor costs in China." The protest ended peacefully after Zulek and the rest of the press conference exited out of a back door. The smiling Qatari security carried no weapons and no body armor, but wore only their traditional white robes. They held lines against the protest by holding hands. José Bové took a photograph with a line of Qatari security. They hugged each other as Bové held his arm-twisting sign. Maud Barlow and a few others followed suit. That was the report from today's action and yesterday's action in Doha, Qatar, by the NGO delegates there, trying to get the point across that this is a totally undemocratic meeting.
Thank you. See all of these people here today at Politics and Prose. Welcome, all of you, on behalf of the owners and all the staff here at Politics and Prose. We're very, very excited to be having this event today. My name is Virginia Harabin. I'm a floor manager here at Politics and Prose. We're so excited to be having an event around this incredible book, Iraq Under Siege, The Deadly Impact of Sanctions and War. When this book was published in the year 2000, so it's not brand new, but it is on the very top of my list of books that I'm recommending to people who are reading right now, and everybody right now is thinking, asking questions, talking to each other and wondering what should we do, what should we support, who are we, all of those kinds of questions. This is an incredible book, an incredible contribution to the body of knowledge about what has been happening in Iraq since the Gulf War, that the war has gone on. We have here the editor of that book, Anthony Arnulf, who is an editor at South End Press. He's also an excellent writer in his own right, a frequent contributor to magazines such as Z, many others, the International Socialist Review. And we have one of the best-known contributors to the book here, Howard Zinn, very well internationally known author of People's History of the United States, Howard Zinn on History, Howard Zinn on War, the Howard Zinn Reader, Marx in Soho, a wonderful activist memoir called You Can't Stay Neutral on a Moving Train. We're going to hear from both speakers, each for about 20 minutes, and then we'll open up the floor for your questions, and then at the end of that, we will have signing. So let's get started, and please welcome A to Z. We'll go A to Z, so Anthony Arnulf first.
Can you hear? Is the microphone picking up enough now? Great. Obviously, the country Iraq has been in the news a lot in recent weeks since the horrific and unconscionable attacks of September 11th. And there have been many references to Iraq and also to the embargo on that country, which has been in place since the invasion of Kuwait in August 6, 1990. The invasion took place August 2, 1990. Sanctions were imposed by the United Nations August 6, 1990. There's been a 10-year comprehensive embargo on the people of Iraq. And there's been many references to that fact and to the fact that the embargo has created a lot of anger in the Middle East, in Arab countries and Muslim countries, about the U.S. role in being the lead advocate and kind of architect of those sanctions policy, even though they're being enforced by the United Nations. It's very clear that the UN, particularly using its role in the Security Council, has been instrumental in maintaining the sanctions, despite the fact that around the world there's a growing chorus of people who are criticizing them and calling for them to be ended. But, you know, we've seen references to that. We've also seen Paul Wolfowitz, who's George Bush's Deputy Secretary of Defense, calling for an expanding of U.S. bombing targets. The United States, as we speak, is bombing Afghanistan. There's a push among sections of the Bush administration to broaden those attacks, and Iraq would be one of the key targets for people like Paul Wolfowitz. William Sapphire, the New York Times columnist, similarly calling for the bombing of Iraq and the overthrow of the Iraqi government and President Saddam Hussein, who sits at the head of the Ba'athist party there. You've had John Negroponte, who's the recently appointed U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, delivering a letter to the Security Council basically saying that the United States is going to broaden its list of targets, not naming any countries, but indicating that Iraq might be one of them. And President Bush has also himself given similar hints that Iraq may be next, among many other countries that have been mentioned, including Malaysia, the Philippines, Indonesia, Syria, Lebanon. But Iraq has a certain way of rising to that top, to the top of that list. But I think despite all the references we've seen to Iraq in the media, there's been very little substantive analysis of what the embargo is, what the impact of it has been, and why it's created so much anger in the Muslim world and in the Arab world, and why it's also created legitimate anger and criticism internationally, not just in those sections of the world. Yeah. And that's one of the reasons why the people who were involved in the project, Iraq Under Siege, undertook this book, was to attempt to present a more systematic, thorough, critical analysis of what this policy is, what the human consequences of it are, and to put a human face on the Iraqi people, because I think that that's very important. The media has not put a human face. All too rarely, when describing Iraq, Iraq is described as if it is a country populated by one person, Saddam Hussein. I mean, the lengths to which the media go are quite striking. I'll quote, this is just one example. This was in the Boston Globe earlier this year. This is how they refer to U.S. policy toward Iraq. The impulsive, impatient Saddam was driven out of Kuwait and suffered sanctions for a decade. Now, it's clear there, the person who's suffering the sanctions is Saddam Hussein. Yet, having been to Iraq myself, having spoken to many people who have been to Iraq, and any serious studies that have been done of the embargo and its consequences on Iraq show that Saddam Hussein is not suffering, the people in power in Iraq are not suffering, but ordinary people are suffering. Children, the elderly, poor, the middle class. There's been a tremendous economic devastation of the country, and that's being felt by millions of ordinary people, not by people in positions of power, some of whom, in fact, are profiting off the sanctions through the black market that's been created, and others of whom have, you know, basically entrenched themselves further in power during the years of the embargo. So I think there's an importance and a real need to get behind the headline, to get behind a very simple account of what's going on in Iraq, to look at what it's about. So just a little bit of background. The embargo was imposed in August of 1990. At the time, it was tied to the fact that Iraq had invaded Kuwait. The Gulf War quite brutally expelled Iraq from Kuwait with tremendous loss of civilian life within Iraq and serious destruction of its social infrastructure, including bombing of things like electricity plants and water sewage treatment plants and other basic infrastructure, which is in complete violation of international law. But then, when that aggression was reversed, the sanctions were continued. And they were then tied to, in some cases, in the words of Madeleine Albright, who is the Clinton administration Secretary of State, regime change, basically using it as a leverage to ensure that the sanctions would remain in place until there was a new government in Iraq, or, in the terms of the United Nations, proof that Iraq no longer possessed capacity to use weapons of mass destruction, biological, chemical, nuclear weapons capacity. And they've remained to this day. They've been modified, they've been tinkered with, but fundamentally, the fact remains that the United States, through its role in the United Nations, particularly through the United Nations Sanctions Committee, determines what gets into Iraq and what does not get into Iraq. And at any given moment, there's billions of dollars worth of goods that Iraq would like to bring into the country that are being kept out, either because they're vetoed by the United States or because they're put on hold by the United States. The Sanctions Committee literally has a stranglehold on what can and cannot come into the country, and they use something called dual-use criteria to keep basic essential items out of the country by arguing that they have a potential military dual use. So, for example, an ambulance can be used to transport someone who's sick to a hospital or someone who's dying to a hospital. It can also be used to transport troops. So one could consider that a dual-use item. And at various points, ambulances have either been kept out or held up and delayed under those criteria. Chlorine, which is essential for the treatment of safe drinking water, has also at various points been delayed or kept out of the country. Chlorinators, other industrial infrastructure. Now, if you go back to the end of the Gulf War, you know, as I mentioned earlier, Iraq was a devastated country. The United Nations visited Iraq right after.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen. You have been listening to No Round Radio. Who knows what the hell that means? This is Blast Furnace Radio, rebroadcasting the folks from Deutschland. The people smashing their set.